So, Tom, you admit that you had a gut feeling one way, and then after running the numbers, you changed your mind. But running the numbers here involved consulting the POH, putting lines on the chart, estimating the wins, consulting a second POH, and putting it all in an Excel spreadsheet. How is this possibly realistic for someone who just had lunch and now has to depart with their family?
Well, sadly, it's not. And yeah, I live in my own little world of airplane data, and I think about such things. But the problem is that a lot of these data are not available to most pilots. If I were flying a V-35 Bonanza, I probably would not know how pronounced the effect of slope is. And so this is why this sort of program is valuable, because you can learn from the experiences of people that fly different types of aircraft. I do know, however, that runway slope is has a big impact on aircraft performance. I think the real key here isn't necessarily the runway slope. It was the surprising effect of a tailwind as compared to a headwind. And that information pilots do have in their pilot's operating handbook. Would you sit down and learn this for the first time or to getting ready to take off with the family on board from a barbecue lunch break? Probably not. It's the sort of thing you need to get into the handbook now and see what impact different types of winds have on the airplane you fly.
Of course, the other big challenge of this scenario is your confidence in the numbers in that pilot operating handbook, right? And that's what causes me to pause here. It's pretty close, the 2,300-foot number on a 2,500-foot runway, based on the numbers in a pilot operating handbook. And I've just seen that those can vary. A lot of times they're optimistic. So I would be very cautious with that. And for that reason, I would tend to take a look at option three and taking off myself and verifying some of these numbers, maybe even making the plane a little lighter, and then coming back around and putting my kids on board.
Richard's point about the POH skepticism is really well taken. This is a 1967 or 68 airplane. The older the POH, the more fictional it becomes. Cirrus POHs I've found to be pretty accurate, but plotting this and risking it all on the data from the POH plus a GPS app that your daughter runs seems really highly suspect to me.
I agree with that. First, I personally apply a significant margin to any POH data. Secondly, what's commonly not taken into account is that in order to get anything even approximating the pilot's operating handbook data, you have to operate the airplane in the way that the pilot's operating handbook tells you to. For most light aircraft, the POH takeoff performance chart specifies what is essentially a short field takeoff technique. In this one in particular, if you look in the resources, you'll see it talks about applying full power before releasing brakes, using maximum runway, rotating at what would be a fairly slow airspeed, and climbing out at a fairly steep angle. That's not the way most people fly this type of airplane. So not only do you have to have the discipline to look at the takeoff performance, but you also then have to realize, what is it I have to do to get anything that's even close to that sort of performance out of the airplane?
I agree totally with that. I think one of the things I've done is bring some transport category numbers back into light airplanes. But in the transport category world, you have to have 115% of runway availability. I bump that up to 25% in light airplanes. The other thing is, Tom's exactly right. Those are based on what we call static thrust, not full power prior to brake release. So, coincidentally, in the transport world, you add 500 feet for a running takeoff, which is typically what most pilots would use. It's a fact that all civil airplanes will land shorter than they'll take off. So, this is something you need to do before you get in. One of the techniques I like to talk about, as I call boxing the parameters. In others, I would take a max gross takeoff weight. I would take a very hot day, 90 degrees, say 2,000 feet density altitude, and see what kind of numbers I have. And that is a clue when I really start needing to look at the book when I get something shorter than that.
But aren't we sort of like, you know, measuring a beach ball with a micrometer here? I mean, we don't even know what the winds are at this airport. We're measuring them from a point, what, 7-8 miles away, I think we said it was. Maybe it's more. And we only have just a windsock giving us a rough idea here. We have a rough idea of what the runway slope is. And the airplane actually is a little bit under gross weight, but we're not exactly sure necessarily how much that was because we flew over, taxied in, burned off a little bit of fuel. So how do you apply this stuff in the real world where you actually do have to decide about a takeoff?
I would kind of invert the solution here and make this about the barbecue. And here's why. So, and this is the flexibility of general aviation on a trip like this. So you don't necessarily have a schedule that you have to keep. So you can fly whatever schedule you want to fly. You want to have a nice lunch. Make that the priority. And I would go into this airport with as light as I could, land, have the nice lunch, not even worry about it. Just glance at the POH, say, yeah, I'm good on this because I'm really light. Make the extra fuel stop. Stress is relieved. We go on our way. And then, because I think when you get into the issue of calculating performance to such a fine degree, you have to perform correctly and you have to trust those numbers. And I frankly don't. And I add at least 25% to Hobie's point, because my technique is probably not going to be that good, and I don't even really know what the airplane weighs. I'm making an estimate at it.
One point that I would look at here is, did the pilot look at this airport before they made the decision to even go there and have a barbecue and think about these things before they got there, or was that decision made, you know, once they got there? Because you would think that you would look at that before you decided to get there, correct? And then another point to Richard's point of, you know, standing and you know, having somebody get out and taking off and seeing if you can make it. I have a story that's a real life story of some pilots. They would take their Cessna 205 into Mexico every year, and they'd go land in these, you know, they'd go land out in the middle of nowhere, really. And there were three people in this airplane, and they landed, and it was a hot day, and they were concerned about density altitude and being able to take off. And one of the pilots actually stayed and stood there on the ground and then watched the airplane take off, and the result was not good. They couldn't climb. They ran into some trees. The airplane caught on fire. Everybody lived from the accident, but one of the pilots had severe burns all over their legs, and then they were out in the middle of nowhere. They had to walk for hours to get help. So I don't know that I would agree with that option.
You know, one of the things real world here is, let's suppose you do run the numbers, and this pilot at least did look beforehand at the chart supplement and wanted a view from above. You do run the numbers. You do have 25% extra. You're feeling good about it. Okay, now it's time to do it. What could somebody do in the real world to help bracket and capture problems before they're airborne and watching the trees come toward the cowling, knowing that, oops, I'm not going to make it? You know, how do you deal with that?
Well, I mean, one thing this pilot has going for him is this is his own airplane that he's got experience in. And if you can't believe the POH data, what can you believe? Well, you can believe your own performance from previous trips in similar situations. You've got runway markings at most runways. You know, load the plane up, do some maximum performance takeoffs, see what it really, how it really does. You know, if you've got to use the POH numbers, what I do is I use my 50-foot AGL number for, that's how long I'm going to be on the runway. And that seems to be pretty close to real world performance.
And that's exactly how I do it. I talked earlier that I apply a margin. That's what I do. I use the 50-foot obstacle distance as my runway requirement distance, and then everything else is extra. option. I really kind of liked parts of option three, and I phrased it facetiously about go give it a shot and then go give it a shot again. There's an option 3A. If you were to have landed on this airport without perhaps doing all of these calculations ahead of time and then determined that it's going to be a real challenging departure, we have to be real careful about deciding that we have got to get everybody and all their baggage out of this airplane, out of this airport some way. And at this point, it's not an emergency, but it's a situation where we have to divert from our original planning. It may be incredibly inconvenient to try to transport the passengers and the baggage to another airport, so you can take off out of here lightly. But it may be that that's the best option if you've got yourself in a situation that you cannot safely extract yourself from.
Yeah, and I think, Tom, none of us are suggesting that you become a test pilot and just apply the throttle and hope you can make it. The book says we can with full load. My inclination was to say, all right, but let me go up and take a look at it myself and verify those numbers, right? But then you make a really good point about sometimes creative problem solving in these situations. And I've seen this done before where the density altitude got a little high, temperature got a little hot. So what we in essence said was, hey, Tom, you're single ship. Can you take my daughter with you? And, hey, about Dave, you take my son and we'll hop out of here and then we'll meet up at some other airport. And then, we do it that way. So relying on other pilots with this sort of creative teamwork approach is a way to get out of airports like that.
When I'm thinking about it, this is a real good illustration of the pilot attitude of resignation. I'm resigned that I have to try to get everybody out of here somehow, some way. And there may be other ways to do it.
Yeah, like there are plenty of other people at the airport. Maybe you wouldn't put your son or daughter with them, but you'd put all your bags with them if they were willing to, if they were willing to help out like that. I want to go back a little bit to, the tailwind takeoff and how surprisingly long that was. And I think one of the real potential traps there with the tailwind landing or tailwind in general, you're going to see the maximum effect for the long time of exposure, right? So a tailwind landing, you're coming in towards the airport and you're seeing for quite a long time, like, wow, I'm moving over the ground a lot. Wow, I'm going to overshoot that threshold and I'm going to go around. So you get a lot of warning with time to still do something about it. You essentially have an abort point. You either were able to put it down on the runway or, wow, that was an amazing overshoot and it's a go around before my wheels even touched. Tailwind takeoff, that's inverted. By the time we see the big effect of the tailwind, we are past the abort point. We're airborne already, right? You don't even notice it nearly as much on the takeoff roll. It's while you're climbing out. That's when it becomes ever stronger and has more of an effect, because that's where you're spending a lot of time, right? So I'm wondering, in terms of an abort point, how many people here would incorporate or how they would incorporate an abort point in the takeoff if they decided to go? And what would that look like? Where would it be?
The typical response here is the 70-50 rule. 70% of your airspeed by the halfway point in the runway. A normal part of any takeoff in this situation would be choosing an abort point on the ground prior to beginning the takeoff roll.
I don't really like the abort point because if you're cutting it that close, you're requiring, first of all, calculations of some kind. You were getting back to Richard's point about the reliable data. And then you're requiring a snap judgment that for a lot of pilots, I think myself included, is likely to be a little rubbery. So you get to your abort point and you say, well, maybe this is looking all right. And you carry it 100 or 200 feet further, and before you know it, you're past your abort point. And you don't have any choices left. In situations like this, I like to have so much reserve performance margin built in that I only have to make a passing glance at the data just to confirm that, what looks right here actually is right.
So what you're really getting at here is goes back to what Richard said earlier, that going to this barbecue restaurant should not itself have been a snap judgment. after the plane's already fueled. It should have been, if you're going to do something that has this tight a margin, you have to include that in your original planning. And a big part of that in this case would be to arrive light, to be able to take off light.
And that becomes the priority, that becomes the goal. And the rest of the calculations and the performance considerations are really secondary, because you're just confirming, yeah, I can do this. And that gets to what Judy said about, okay, if I'm going to do this, I will have looked at it. Oh, this runway is only 2,500 feet, 35 feet wide. God, I'm heavy in this thing. So, yeah, I got to figure out. Otherwise, just go to another airport.
And the incredible freedom of general aviation makes it very easy and tempting for us to make these snap decisions without doing all of the homework. So that's probably the real lesson here.
Well, it also sounds like part of it is the very last thing you should do is refuel your airplane before you depart, so that you've got your fuel load planned for that next airport, whatever it is.
Yeah, but I'm going to take exception to something Paul said, because it's like the reason you have an abort point is precisely because you don't want to be fudging. It gives you an ironclad place where it's, you can say, this is my point. If I've either got the speed or I don't at this point. It's really helpful because you don't have that nagging doubt during the takeoff roll. Does it sound right? Is my acceleration normal? You'll pay attention to those things, but at the same time, you'll know that if I reach this place without this preset number on my airspeed indicator, I know exactly what I'm going to do.
I want to revisit a point, Jeff, we made in the last session, and that is if you are out flying your airplane and having adventures with it, you're going to find yourself in situations like this, maybe not quite this, but like this, where you're really having to think through, all right, I got myself in this corner here. How am I going to get out of it? And I think, you know, at the end of the day, if you just keep thinking about fall back to the basics, you know, and that is, I'm never going to take off out of somewhere that I'm not certain I can take off out of there. You know, I mean, that should not be a question. And so realizing the point I'm trying to make is just to realize that as you're listening to this, don't think, well, I'm just never going to get myself in that situation. Well, it's likely you are. You know, if you're out flying your airplane, you're having some adventure, you are. So to have some rules of thumb about how you're going to do it and to think about some of the things Tom mentioned with creative problem solving is helpful.
One more thing on this scenario. Let's suppose that it did make sense to you, or you did go with your gut that you were going to take off in the other direction. This is a busy, uncontrolled airport with lots of people coming and going. How do you manage that when you're like, look, I am going to be the rugged individualist. To heck with all you people. I'm taking off in the other direction. But there are a number of other aircraft. How do you work with a group, you know, the collective hive mind?
I think there's a great point to make there about the collaboration among GA pilots. Most of the time, if you decided that, you're going to be standing around with a bunch of other pilots watching people take off and say, I don't agree with that. I think I'm going to go take off the other way. And somebody that is a data cruncher like Tom is going to go, well, let's talk about that. You know? So, yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead, Tom.
No, I was going to say, however, if let's say, for instance, that the numbers did show that taking off in the other direction is the proper thing to do, everybody else is doing it wrong, and you're the only one that's getting it right. If, in fact, that were the case, then you do have a couple of things you're going to have to do here. One is try to talk to as many pilots before, you know, who are getting ready to go. Okay, can you give me a minute? I'm going to go the other way. I'm just going to do that. Secondly, the scenario does mention there's a multicom frequency. So at least you have, if people are participating, or at least for those who are participating, you have the opportunity to warn them. And then third, you're just going to have to take your time, wait for your opportunity, and be very, very vigilant, watching out for other traffic. But if you are patient, yes, this may be a busy airport. I imagine a place that's well known for a restaurant will be busy for a relatively short period of time. You might have to wait a little while, but eventually the traffic's going to thin out.
So looking at this from the big view and trying to take away what someone would learn from this scenario, it really sounds like pre-planning, figuring out beforehand how you're going to get out of a place before you actually plan to go into the place, since that's something you're going to want to do and not want to leave on a truck, and having the right kind of data available for your airplane, you know, having a realistic takeoff run and climb that you know you can do with your technique and your plane, with your engine and how it's bent or modded or anything like that, with the appropriate amount of fudge factor. And some people disagreed about it, but maybe having some kind of ironclad rules, whether it's the abort point or whether it's how much over the minimums is going to be your personal minimum for what you're willing to do. That's the way to be able to go into places like this, enjoy a great barbecue lunch, and know that you can still get back out with your family safely.